We'll switch then to what you can do with Java. And there's two different sort of layers of this. There's a security stuff which is built into Java 1.4 onwards, or 1.2 onwards. This is useful for some cases. We'll need this for later on probably, but for the immediate thing of encryption and decryption, it doesn't really help very much. But anyway, it looks like it would do. There's a thing called a security manager. And when you start a Java program, any Java program, you can say that it must run with a security manager by just doing the define, minus D, java.securityManager. Alternatively, as well as this command line thing, which anyone can use, you can also explicitly set it in the code by saying system.securityManager and then pass in a security manager object. Once you've got security management put in place, you're restricted to the things that the program can then do. So if there's already a security manager, it might say, no, you can't put a new one in. So this may fail if there's already one there. Okay. But if it's null, you can always set one. There is, at the moment, there is only one standard security manager, and that's related to RMI. So the remote method invocation, there's an RMI security manager, and the purpose of that is to say, what you're doing with RMI is you're downloading code from somewhere else that's going to run on your computer from within your virtual machine. Because it's foreign code, well, you want to be able to download it, but you want to be able to restrict what that foreign code can do. So the RMI security manager puts in the security layer that says, yes, it's okay to pull code across the network, but that code can't do anything nasty when it's on your computer. So all that RMI can do is talk back to where it came from. So it's kind of a sandbox model that's put in place on your local machine. If you're going to run with a security manager, you also need a security policy. And you define that by saying java.security.policy equals the name of a file, and that file has got a policy inside it. Okay. What the policy does, so this is the contents of the file, inside that file, the policy says what permissions, what things are allowed to do that are controlled by the security policy. And they're all in terms of permissions. So you're granting some permission to do something. And there's a whole range of these. So there's a file permission, runtime permission, etc. Lots of these, network permissions and so on. And they normally have some parameters. So what this one is saying, for file permission, it's saying, in the /temp directory, any of the objects can read and write files in the /temp directory. For runtime permissions, exit VM, exit virtual machine, is set to true. And what that means is an object can call system.exit and will succeed because exit virtual machine is set to true. Okay. What's not granted, for example, by these, file permission is granted for /temp. It's not granted for any other directory. So you can't read, write in any other directory. There's no permissions to manipulate threads. So something running in one thread can't stop another thread. You can't look at the Java event queue. You can't do a whole bunch of things. Only things you can do, system.exit and read, write to /temp. So those are the sort of kind of things that the security policy's got in there. What it applies to, there are different classes of files, or different types of files. So if anything's picked up from the JRE lib extension directory, that's completely trusted. So what these are, sometimes you'll come across a package that says, I should be installed in that directory, JRE lib ext. If you don't trust the person who's given you those files, don't do it. because what's put in that directory, no security checks are ever done on those. They can do anything, reformat the disk and so on. So they're completely trusted by the virtual machine. Okay. Classes in local jar files, local class files, they can be subject to these policies. Same with local jar files. Remote classes are the ones that you don't really want to trust very much. And the permissions, okay, so the simple types of permissions, the permissions can be refined so that you can say certain classes can have these permissions depending on where they come from and or whether or not they are signed as in that public-private key type signatures. So here's another type of one. This would be a network type permissions. So it's saying that socket permissions are being granted, and there's the name of the host that it's coming from, and the type of permissions that are being granted. So connect and accept. So you'll be running a server. What you're allowing is clients on that host, 224.0.1.85. You're allowing clients from there to connect to your server, and it will accept connections from that server. A weaker permission for a wider domain, this would say that star.edu.au, anyone from any university, any computer in the edu domains, on port 80, they can connect. So a wider group of people, but less permissions there. You can also grant down to things called code bases. So this would say that if you're downloading code from a particular machine by an HTTP connection, so this is some jar files that are sitting over on that computer, and what this is saying is if you pull any jar files, remote files from there, then when you run those, they can do anything, all permission. Okay. There's also digital signatures that can be attached to them, so that if you say any file that I get from anywhere, if it's signed by that person, sysadmin, then they can do anything too. So you can control things, where they came from, what types of connections are being made, where the files are coming from, whether they're signed, all sorts of things. If you're looking at things like signed by, somewhere it means you've got to keep a public key. So you need to keep a public key for this thing called sysadmin. So firstly, you've got to have a file somewhere, knows sysadmin, and associated with it that public key. And what's done in Java is to use key stores. Okay. And we'll be using these key stores for some other things too later on. If you're looking at, so there's related things. If you're looking at this thing called this appears within the policy file. So this is in the security policy, saying that it's signed by. What the Java runtime has to know is, if you're saying it's signed by that, where is it going to find the key store? Where is it going to find that information? So within the policy file, you specify where the key store is. And you say, for example, it's a particular file, homejan.keystore, and it's a type Java keystore, JKS. So I should have one of them. Let's find a big shell. Okay, quit. Minus L, tilde slash dot key. Ah, maybe I don't. Well, I used to have one. I got them in all sorts of places, but not where I thought. There's one in here. CD dot security. Okay, minus L key store. Okay, so there's a key store. If you try looking inside it, what is it? File. Just contains binary data. So if you try and look inside it, it doesn't look very nice. Okay. So it's just binary stuff in there, which is understood by Java. We'll come up with an example later on in actually manipulating it. But how you do things with a key store is by using this key tool. And these all take an argument of key tool minus key store, and then you say where it is, and then some sort of command that goes with it. Minus list, store password, generate a key, export, and so on. So let's see if I can try running here. Clear. Key tool minus key. Key store minus list. Oops. Oh well, that didn't work, did it? I wonder what I did. I'll create one later on to see what the password is later. Make one up later. Okay, so it prompts you for a password. I don't know. We'll recreate one later on. Okay, once you've got a key store set up, there's another program called Jar Signer. So if you need to sign jar files, use that program. That's about it for the sort of standard stuff that's in all of the Java things. But they've also come up with a cryptography extension called JCE. And this goes back to what we were talking about a little while ago, DES and RSA, all these different encryption algorithms. JCE supports all of those. It knows about these algorithms by name. So, for example, there's the DES encryption. That's just a generic DES algorithm. But there's all sorts of variations on DES and CBC, cyclic block code, something like that. So what sort of padding is done at the end of these things. All sorts of little variations. If you want to specify all of those, you can. Otherwise, you just use something simple like DES. Okay. Some of the public-private key ones. I haven't mentioned those. RSA, I'll fill in the gap later on and so you can see some of the public key ones. All of the stuff is manipulated by a class called Cypher. And how you get a Cypher object is by using a factory method. So the implementations of these, they're sort of pluggable, different implementations can be used, but you just use the cipher static method and you get a cipher object by get instance. And what you feed in for that is a description of what the cipher is. So you do get instance of DES, get instance of RSA. For whatever cipher you want to use, you put that in there. And then you get a cipher object. Because there's so much variation in all the different types of algorithms, there's lots and lots of different methods, and some methods work better with some algorithms and some work better with others. So I'm not going to go through all the details. This is just the simplest. Okay. So in order to get an algorithm going, some need some sort of starting off point. So to make sure that they start correctly, you use init. And so there's a couple of init mechanisms. We'll do those in a minute. So init, you're saying, are you going to use this algorithm for encryption? Are you going to use it for decryption? Because some algorithms, it makes a difference. Some it doesn't. So whatever. But once you've got that, again, some of them will allow you to do bits at a time. Some of them will allow you to do big chunks. The easiest way is this one called doFinal, which says, no matter what you do in the middle, just give me the answer at the end. So this is the simplest way of saying, forget about, I don't want to know the details, just give me the final encrypted thing that I'm after. And you feed it in a series of bytes. So you can encrypt binary data, characters, whatever you want to encrypt, but they have to appear as a byte array. Once you got them as a byte array, You can encrypt them or decrypt them to another byte array. Okay. So as a simple example, take the Echo server. So this was the Echo server. It just encrypts, just whatever you send it, it sends back. Except we'll now assume that we're using what's sent to it is desencrypted data, and you're going to send back desencrypted data. So the first part of it is the same as we've had for previous ones. We've got a port, set up a server socket on that port, an infinite loop to accept the socket. And once you've got the socket, then pass it off to something else to handle each of the client sockets in turn. Handle socket. So we're passing in a socket. You want an input stream, data input stream. Okay, here's a little bit of a difference already. We're not dealing with a text algorithm, so we're not using print stream and buffered reader. We're dealing with binary data, encrypted binary data. So you want the stuff that will handle byte streams. So you want a data input stream and a data output stream in order to manage things. If you're using DES, then you need to have some sort of a key identifier. So you have a separate key for each user, and that's stored in an 8-byte array. So I think it's 8, is it? A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Does it go up to H? H, okay. So you create an 8-byte array, and each individual should have a separate key for this. So this is just the same for ease. So you set up a key, and then you got to, because I say all of them are different, for the DES stuff you have to go through these little hoops. So you need to create a DES key specification based upon that 8-byte key. And it may not work, so you catch an invalid key exception. Once you got that, you want to turn it into, DES is a secret key algorithm, so we want to get something that will handle secret keys. So you ask for a secret key factory that will handle DES algorithms. So firstly, you need to create, using a factory to create a factory to generate from that factory a secret. And where does that secret come from? The 8-byte key got turned into a DES key spec. That DES key spec is now turned into a DES secret key. So, kind of messy. All right. So this is the secret key after those steps. The secret key that's going to be used by the cipher algorithms to encrypt and decrypt. So we're going to do it two ways. We're going to read some stuff in, decrypt that, and then we'll encrypt it and send it back out using the same key. So we'll have an in cipher and an out cipher, one for decrypting on the way in, the other for the way out. You could use separate keys, separate algorithms, just using the same one. Okay. A bunch of exceptions for if it doesn't know about DES algorithms and so on. And then, okay, now you finally start getting down to it. Before we can use the cipher, so this is what we'll actually be using for the encryption decryption, you have to initialize it. And one we're initializing for decrypt, the other we're initializing for encrypt, but both of them are using the same secret key. Okay. Then you have a loop. Okay. And now this loop goes while true. So this is the loop which is handling all of the different messages backwards and forwards. Okay. One of the things that we're getting from this, we started from, remember the original Echo server, what that was doing was sending a line of text finished by a new line, and then you would echo that line back. Okay. Now we're dealing with binary data. We can't say read a line because we don't know that there's a new line character at the end. It might be part of the binary data. So rather than a text-based one which says read until you hit the end of line, you need something that's going to talk about binary data. So we'll change that that protocol a little bit to say what comes down first is a byte that says how big the data is, followed by the binary data. So what the client should be doing is, before it sends the encrypted data across, it should first of all send a byte saying how big it is, and then the data. Okay. So on the other side, we first read how big it is by reading a byte, create an array big enough to hold that data, and then read those bytes. So there's the encrypted data come in. And if something didn't match, then break out of the loop. The input decrypted stuff is some byte array, again. So we then ask, in Cypher, InCypher is doing a decrypt, so we ask it to do all of the decryption on those in bytes, and that will be the decrypted text. And a bunch of different types of exceptions. If the data was corrupted along the way or something, you'd throw those. That's a byte array. If you want to say print that message on the client, on the server side, then this just turns it into a string. The constructor takes the byte array, turns it into a string, prints it to the server side, checks whether it was the exits by command, and so on. Sending it back, the string, you turn into a byte array. You ask the encryption cipher to do all its stuff and give you a byte array of encrypted data. And send that back to the client, write byte, so you need to send it back, same sort of format, how many bytes followed by them. So ask that byte array how long it is, and write it as a byte, and then write the encrypted data. That's all there is to it. Okay, so basically there's a lot that you sort of just copy from this, but the main differences are that once you got it set up, you're just reading and writing bytes, encrypt, decrypt, using that cipher object. Okay. We're going for time. I don't think it's worth running it because it's going to do nothing different. It'll just say, hello, 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 bye. You know. But what it will have done in the meantime, and I haven't got the client code there, but it'll just encrypt, decrypt, and you don't see it happening particularly. Okay. There's another way of doing it. So that is, by doing it that way that I just talked about, that's where you have control over which algorithm you're using. You're encrypting it yourself, you're decrypting it yourself. There is another protocol, SSL Secure Sockets, and this is the one that's used by Netscape, IE, and so on for secure HTTP connections, but you can use it for anything. It was introduced by Netscape, and you can run all sorts of services on top of it, like HTTP, Secure IMAP, all of these use SSL underneath. And if you're using a browser, you get a broken key, which becomes an okay key when you're doing this. It's been standardized, and it's been standardized by the Internet Task Force, so it's one of the good algorithms. And it uses this combination. Firstly, if you want to talk to somebody, you can insist upon identification by using public keys. So usually you might want to say, I want to verify who the server is. So if you've got the public key for the server, then the server can sign it using their private key. You can verify it using using their public key. Once any of this authentication's done, then it switches to a secret key and carries on much faster. It was originally Java Secure Socket Extensions. That's part standard part of 1.4 and is the standard way of getting SSL. Okay, last time I tried it, I couldn't get it to work with certificates, so you can try it, see how you go. But what you do is, this is as much as possible, what they've done is to copy the ordinary socket mechanism, but just call it secure sockets. So right at the beginning, a little bit of a difference in that you need to talk to an SSL server socket factory. And you use that get default to get the factory. And this factory will then be used to create server SSL sockets. Once you've got the SSL socket factory, then you use that factory to create a server socket. And this is just like an ordinary server socket in that it takes a port number. So it's a secure socket which is listening on that particular port. And instead of being just a server socket, it's an SSL server socket. Okay. Next bit is just the same as what we've had before. Socket.connect is waiting for an incoming socket, and this one we're then going to run in its own thread. So create a new socket handler and start that running in its own thread there. So the server socket, whatever the socket is incoming, that's it. Well, that is actually it, because all of the stuff related to server sockets is all handled by the server socket library. So that what you've actually got passed into the socket handler is just an ordinary socket. So all of the encryption's done for you, and decryption is done. All you have to do is an SSL server socket. Okay. And then there's nothing different. If your Echo protocol was line oriented, well, you're sending lines as before. All of the wrapping up into binary data, unwrapping from binary data, it's all being done by the service, the SSL server socket stuff. So that code doesn't change. Okay. And the Echo client, how's that different? Okay, where does it start getting different? Create a new socket. So this is the Echo client. It wants to talk to the remote machine on a particular port. So it creates an ordinary socket. So client talking to server. But then what you need to do with that ordinary socket is to wrap it up inside an SSL socket so that the encryption decryption will take place. So firstly, you get the SSL socket factory again. And then, using that SSL socket factory, you create an SSL socket from the ordinary socket. So we created an ordinary socket to talk to the server. We now pass that as an argument to this create SSL socket. Which machine you're talking to, just confirm that. And which port. And I can't remember what the last one's for. So that this now has taken the socket that talks to the remote machine, wrapped it in a server, an SSL socket to talk to that remote machine on that port, and you got an SSL socket. Okay, from there. That's the main difference, because now that you've got the SSL socket, you use the SSL socket to create all of the readers and writers that you wanted to use. So SSL socket get input stream, we want an input stream reader, we want to send text, lines of text to it, so we use a buffered reader, we want to read lines of text, we want to send lines of text, so we use a print stream. And they're just constructed from the SSL socket's input and output stream. And then the rest of it's as before, send text, read text, on. Okay, where this gets trickier is for running it, because for running it you've got to create keys. So to get it going, first of all you need to start off by generating a key for the key store, and this alias would be what's the name that you're creating it under, and what's the password for that key store? Okay. So using that will generate a key. So gen key, and you don't see what the key is. It just gets generated in some sort of background mode, and you don't see what it is. But what you need to do, so that will create the private and the public key. If you're using, Des uses the public key mechanism for authentication. What you need to do, so if you're the server, you run this first one, generate a key for the server, and it gives you private public key. What you need to do is to get the public key out of that key store, give it to the client, and the client will then say, I'm going to take this public key from over there and put it in what's usually called a trust store. So the trust store is people that you trust from elsewhere. So there's the key store, which stores the private public, the trust store, which just has other people's public keys in them. So firstly, you've got to get that public key out of this key store. So you need to export it. So export it, and you export it into a certificate file. So whatever the name is, doesn't matter what the name is. And that's supposed to be an X509 certificate. You send that off, email, whatever, write it down on a piece of paper. You send it off to the client. And then what the client wants to do is to the reverse, import. And this is where the client says what name that they're going to use for the other person into their trust store, and then this file that's been sent to them. Okay. And then when you want to run the server, you give all of these things. What's the key store and your name of your key store file? What's the key store password? And then your server. Okay. And the client goes the other way. The client needs to be able to find the other person's public key. So what's the trust store that it's using? What's the password for the trust store? And then the client talking to the remote host. And if it doesn't work, there's a debugging flag. Okay. Yeah. The key store, no, because these are actually, logically, they're on different machines. So the question was, is the key store password and the trust store password the same? No, the key store password is the password that the server is using. The trust store password is the password the client is using. So normally they'd be different because all that's been exchanged between the client and the server is the public key as this X509 certificate. So, any other questions? No? Okay.